We're at a milestone at this point. We are at the end of Jesus' explanation of what's going to happen in the end times. We have a lot of this sermon left to go all the way through the end of chapter 25, but the rest of it is all about the timing of it and how we're to behave in the meantime, how we're to act, and what we're supposed to do, how we're to comport our lives. But basically, we're done with the information about exactly what's going to happen. So, I want to review it, and I want to compare it to what we see in the book of Revelation. I wasn't going to do this at all. It's going to go on to the next passage until Friday afternoon. Rush Limbaugh persuaded me to do this. I was listening to Rush Limbaugh, and he came on. Some guy said, "I'm a born again Christian. I've given my heart to Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior." And Rush Limbaugh said, "Me too. I have too." He said, "But I don't agree with the book of Revelation, and I don't agree that it belongs in the Bible. It's way too apocalyptic, and there's some guy at some seminary that disagrees with this, and he says it shouldn't even be in the Bible. We should get rid of it. It's not part of Scripture. And it's bizarre, you know, and stuff." And he just went on. And then earlier this week also, I was reading a book that said this book was arguing against some theological view. And the argument that they gave was the only place where you see that taught is the book of Revelation, which, you know, who knows what the book of Revelation means. And we certainly should, this guy's thesis was we certainly shouldn't base any theological view that we only see in the book of Revelation. There is a tendency to disparage the book of Revelation. And a lot of people have wanted to remove it from the canon altogether, like Rush Limbaugh does. Let me read you the beginning of the book. Martin Luther. If you have a tendency towards that direction, if you want to sort of relegate the book of Revelation to obscurity, I want you to read this. The revelation, verse 1, of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw, that is, the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it, and to take part what is written in it, because the time is near. If you are going to dismiss the book of Revelation from your thinking, and you're going to say that it's not part of God's word, you better be right. Because if you're wrong, look at the end of the book. I think John maybe knew after he wrote this stuff that people would have this attitude towards something like this that's difficult to understand. And so at the end of the book, in verse 18 of the last chapter, he says, "I warn everyone who hears the word, the prophecy of this book, if anyone adds anything to them, God will add to him the plagues described in this book." That's some curse right there. "And if anyone takes the words away from this book of prophecy, God will take away from him his share in the tree of life and in the holy city, which are described in this book." If you're going to take away these words, you better be right that it's not God's words. Here's why I want to talk about the book of Revelation. Remember when I told you when we started the study of Matthew 24 that basically what's going to happen is Jesus in the Sermon on the Olivet Discourse is going to lay out the end times perspective for the church, and the Bible writers who write after that are expounding on Jesus' teaching. So we have to be solid in our mind of what Jesus' teaching is before we can ever understand things like the book of Revelation. Now we've completed Jesus' teaching on the end time events. In that sermon. Like I say, from here on out, he just tells us how to live in the meantime. But we've completed his description of the actual events. So let's see how it works out. If that helps us understand the book of Revelation. Now, what are the events? If you look on this side of your sheet, where it says Matthew 24, and then the seals and the trumpets and so on, we have these boxes at the top. I got four of them. These are the four sections of the things that Jesus talked about. The first one, verses 4 through 8. Let's go to Matthew 24 and we'll take a look at this stuff. Ask the question. Jesus begins to answer verse 4. "Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Christ, and You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you're not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. These are all the beginnings of the birth pains. Okay, so that's the beginnings of the birth pains. Verses 4-8. So that's the period, the church age. This is the period we're living in right now, the beginning of the birth pains, when all these things that you just described, it says wars, rumors of wars, nation rising against nation, kingdom against kingdom, earthquakes in various places. That's what the conversation on Rush Limbaugh was precipitated by. Some caller called up and said, we know that it's the end times because Jesus predicted all this. And Rush Limbaugh correctly said, no, this has been happening. This happens every day. And he was right. This is the stuff that happens from the time of Jesus all the way up to the second coming, this beginning of the birth thing. So verses 4 through 8 are now. Then we enter into a new period, verse 9. It says, you'll be handed over all the way from 28. I'm not going to read through this all, but it says you'll be handed over, and basically it talks about persecution, the great apostasy, then the abomination that causes desolation, which involves both the apostasy and the Antichrist becomes the man of sin and does dreadful things that are idolatrous and let those who are in Judea flee and all that stuff. All persecution, abomination, man of sin, that whole scene, all the way to verse 28. We can sum it all up with the word abomination. And this is the activity of the Antichrist in that section. So you got this period here, then you've got the activity of the Antichrist. Then you've got, starting in verse 29, it says, immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened. The moon will not give its light. Stars will fall from the sky. That's a meteor storm. And the heavenly bodies will be shaken. So it's a massive cosmic cataclysm. I don't know how to spell cataclysm, but anyway, that's verse 29. A massive cataclysm that's in the sky and involves the whole earth and everything. The heavenly bodies are upset. And then what comes next? Then the sign of the Son of Man, verse 30, in the sky, all the nations will mourn. You'll see the Son of Man coming in power in the sky, the clouds and everything, and he'll appear with great glory with all his angels, and the loud trumpet call, and then he'll gather his elect from one end to the other. Remember, that's the harvest. That's the Old Testament imagery of the harvest. So, verses 30 and 31 is the second coming and the harvest. That's how it breaks down. That's basically Jesus' scenario of the end time. That's how it happens. Now, with that in mind, if we take that as our assumption, that that's what was circulating in the early church, that's what everyone believed, that's what everyone understood about the end times, then we read the book of Revelation. And let's see. Now, remember I told you another thing we want to do with prophecy, instead of getting into all the theories of what images possibly mean, what I would like to do in this course is just stick with what we know for sure. What's real clear in the Bible. What do we know for sure from the book of Revelation? Some people say, well, nothing. There are some things that are pretty certain, and you can tell how clear they are. What's clear in the book of Revelation? You can tell what's clear in the book of Revelation by looking at all the various commentaries and seeing where they match. If all the diversity of views in the book of Revelation, if they all agree on some points, you can be sure that that must be something that's fairly clear. Here's the basic outline that is people are in agreement on the book of Revelation. Chapter 1 of the prologue, chapters 2 and 3, the letters to the churches, everyone agrees on that. It's pretty simple. That's the things that are taking place now, when he says, I'll show you the things that are now and the things that are yet to come. The whole rest of the book is the yet to come. Now, the book of Revelation itself gives us that outline. Chapters 4 and 5 we studied in our worship series. Remember, chapters 4 and 5 have to do with the heavenly court They don't say anything that takes place on earth. It's just this stuff, this worship that's going on in heaven, and that's where we're introduced to the seals. Actually, chapter 5 is where it talks about the seals. The purpose of chapters 4 and 5, chapter 4 and 5 are very important in understanding the book of Revelation. The purpose of those chapters is to show us that the whole consummation of all of human history is orchestrated from heaven. The creation does not have the ability to bring itself to its consummation. God has to do it. Only God. Remember, they looked and looked, couldn't find anybody who could open the seals. The seals are what bring about the consummation of all things. Nobody can do it except who? The Lamb. Only God Himself. And so God is the only one that can bring about the consummation of all things. It's important. And by the time we get done, my goal is, by the time we get done, we'll love the book of Revelation. I believe that during the tribulation time, the tribulation, the people that are going through the tribulation will treasure the book of Revelation. And one reason they'll treasure it is they'll see that it's all being run from heaven. It's all being orchestrated. It's not out of control. Remember when I told you that's the value when we did our hermeneutics class? That's the value of apocalyptic literature, one of the values of it. Apocalyptic literature tends to give you this concept of the transcendence of God, the fact that He's above all this mess that's happening to me, and that's very encouraging in real difficult times. Okay, so that's chapter 4 and 5. Now, chapters, let's see here what the divisions are. Make sure I get it right. Chapters 6 and 7 are the seals. The seven seals. Now, that a seal is, it's when you open up a scroll, you open it a little ways, and then there's some wax that's melted in there that you can't open it any farther than that without breaking the wax. And only the people of the proper authority can break the wax seal. Well, the Lamb can do that. If he breaks the first seal, reveals a little bit more what's going to happen. Breaks the next seal and reveals a little bit more. Breaks the next, and that's what the seven seals are. Nobody disagrees with this. Chapters 6 and 7 are about the seven seals. Okay? That's crystal clear. Chapters, now we're just sticking with stuff we know for sure. Chapters 8 through 11, and sorry if you can't see all this, but I just can't really stand anywhere. But chapters 8 through 11 are the trumpets, right? The seven trumpets. Nobody disagrees that chapters 8 through 11 are about the seven trumpets. Everyone agrees with that. Then you have chapters 12 through 14. Chapter 12 through 14 is, well, we'll skip that for now. And then we'll go to 15 through 16. The reason I'll skip that is because there's no title that everyone would agree on. So we'll go to 15 to 16. Everyone agrees this is the seven bowls of wrath that are poured out. Chapters 15 and 16. 17 to 21 is the climax of the book. That's the transfer from the city of Babylon to the city of the New Jerusalem. I'll talk about that at the end. I hope we have time, because that's the real exciting stuff. That's the changeover from the city of Babylon to the city of the New Jerusalem. Now, so the only one that we don't have labeled here is 12 through 14. We could label this so that everyone would agree. The section that's in between the trumpets and the bowls. Okay? Or we could label it something else. I've labeled it conflict with Satan. This, the whole section seems to be about conflict with Satan. The whole story of the conflict with Satan. But whatever you agree on, everyone, whatever you want to title it, everyone would agree that this is a section, because everyone agrees that these are all sections, and that's what's left. Okay? So that's the major divisions of the book. We know that. It's real clear in the book. Now, let's take our bias that we now have from... let me get me something to erase. Tracy, can you grab it for me? But our bias that we have from Matthew 24 and our understanding of what's going to happen in the end, and let's just read the book of Revelation and see what how it shakes out. First, let's look at the... we're going to skip the heavenly court. We've already studied chapters 4 and 5. Let's go to chapter 6 of Revelation. Chapter 6. Now here we have the seals. Seals 1 through 4. First seal in verse 1 is war. Second seal, verse 3, is lawlessness and bloodshed. Very similar, sounds also like war, but maybe it's lawlessness instead. The third seal is, verse 5, famine. Food is real, real expensive, and there's no food to eat. Seal number 4 in verse 7 is death. And these aren't my opinions. This is just what it says. I'm not going to read the whole book, but this is exactly what it says. Seal number 5 is a little different. And 5, 6, and 7 are different. But those first ones are really war, fighting, famine, death. Now, where does those kinds of seals with this extreme war, famine, fighting, and death fit in? When you look at the Jesus' servant, where does the wars and the famine and all that fit in? Maybe something like this. Because the wars, rumors of wars, all that stuff, the normal, and famines, that's just normal. Although, when you read through the first four seals, it kind of sounds like it's worse than normal. So maybe it's towards the end of the birth pain. But you get that, it seems real consistent with this. In fact, if you look at Matthew 24, maybe I should keep a bookmarker in here. If you look at Matthew 24, nation rising against nation, that's seals 1 and 2. Kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famine. The very next sentence, there's famine. That's seal number 3. And then verse 9, the very next verse, verse 8, birth pangs, then you'll be handed over to be persecuted. There is a new section. And where does persecution come in with the seals? Seal 5. Very good. Yeah. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who have been slain because of the word of God and the testimony that they have maintained. They called out in a loud voice, "How long until we're vindicated and all this stuff avenged?" So basically, that's all about the persecuted, martyred saints. So if we scoot this over, I had the box in the wrong place on your notes, I think, but this is seals number 1 through 4. One through four. Now, where does the persecution come in? That's all part of this section, right? The abomination and the Antichrist and all that. So that's seal number 5. And then seal number 6. Let's see what happens to seal number 6. I watched as he opened the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake. Sun turned black, like sackcloth. Moon turned red. Stars went out. They fell down like figs. Mountains are up. Eve and everything else. What does that sound like? How could you sum that up with one word? Cataclysm, right. Word that I can't spell. So here, this is number 6. Right there. Now you have parenthetical interlude. And you get these time to time in the book of Revelation. We know it's a parenthetical interlude. Again, that's not a matter of opinion. It's absolutely established because it says there's 7 seals. We just saw 6. You say, where's number 7? It's in chapter 8, verse 1, 7th seal. So you've got a parenthesis in between seal number 6 and seal number 7. This whole chapter 7 is a parenthesis, an interlude. So chapter 7 is an interlude, and it's about the redeemed. And these interludes, these parenthetical statements in the book of Revelation, are statements about the redeemed. And this is why the book is going to be precious. This is why I think this book was written. It's for these people that go through all this. And it's going to be precious to those people, because they will see these things and they'll be reminded of all these little parenthetical statements. Now, the 144,000, I'm not going to get into interpreting who that is, but they are believers. They end up being believers, whether or not they are here. Then the great multitude in heaven, the 144,000 on earth, the great multitude in heaven, that's chapter 7. So the redeemed and purified people. Now, without commenting too much on that, because we have to get through the whole book, let's go on to the chapter 8. By the way, you say, what is the seventh seal? The seventh seal is nothing. Chapter 8, verse 1, when he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about a half an hour. You're left hanging. You're just kind of left hanging at the seventh seal. And then there's all this rumblings and lightning and thunder and Mount Sinai type activity of the presence of God. And then all of a sudden we're into the trumpets. So it's like seal number 7 is like this. Dot, dot, dot. And you, he's leaving you hanging. You got the end. You know the end. That's not the end. You know there's something to come after that. But he's saying, okay, let's go to something else. Trumpets. Seven trumpets. Starting in chapter 8. What are the seventh trumpet? And I got a yellow marker, and I just mark it. Every time you see an ordinal, you know, the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, I just put them yellow so I can really spot these things. It's a little helpful when you read the book of Revelation. Okay. Again, 1 through 4, we can group together. Number 1, hail and fire hurled down on the earth. All the grass, everything's burned up. It's a catastrophe. Number 8, verse 8, trumpet number 2, a huge mountain, all on fire, thrown into the sea. A third of the sea turned to blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea were destroyed. Ships were destroyed. Huge mess. Number 3, verse 10. Trumpet number 3, there's a great star that falls from the sky and hits the rivers and the springs, and they turn bitter. And number 4, verse 12, the sun is struck, and the moon, and a third of the stars. Now, if you want to see the progression there, you can just circle. Take a pen and circle in verse 7 the word earth, in verse 8 the word sea, in verse 10 the word rivers, in verse 12 the word sun, moon, and stars. Now this is judgment on the earth, the sea, the rivers, and the sun, moon, and stars. Now the reason I told you to circle those is you'll see why that becomes significant in a minute. What are those four? If we group those four together, where would we put that in our thing here? Cataclysm, isn't it? Yeah. Right here. These are trumpets numbers 1 through 4.
When it says the great star,
it can't be. Yeah, that word star, asteria is the word, it's in the Greek word, very general word, means any kind of light up there. It's a meteor, is what it is. And they knew about meteors and they called them stars. I mean, they called them asteras. So, yeah, that's no problem. Yeah, obviously it's not a sun crashing into the sea and then it harms the sea. I guess so. I mean, it would disintegrate the earth before it got it a million miles away. All right, so the last three, and by the way, how do you know to group these first four together? That grouping happens by the actual text itself. Look at verse 13 of chapter 8. As I watched, I heard an eagle that was flying in midair call out in a loud voice, "Woe! Woe, woe, to the inhabitants of the earth, because of the trumpet blasts about to be sounded by the other three angels." We've gone through four, we got three more. The last three trumpets are three woes. So the trumpets are getting worse. And the first four are kind of grouped together, earth, sea, rivers, and sun, moon, and stars. Now the last three, chapter 9, verse 1, trumpet number 5. And basically, trumpet number 5 is, if you think of the first four as natural disaster, then number 5 we can call demonic disaster. Number 5, the demons are let loose. They come up out of hell, and they absolutely create incredible disaster, and horrible things happen. And the description of them is absolutely horrendous. It goes through the first 11 verses of chapter 9. Okay, then number 6, trumpet number 6, verse 13, is just a mass slaughter. The angel comes and these four angels are released. There's a gathering of armies, and it's just a huge mass slaughter. A third of mankind is slaughtered. So number 6, we can just put slaughter. Before we get to number 7, number 7, if you're wondering where it is, it's all the way in chapter 11, verse 15. So before we get to trumpet 7, we got another interlude here, another parenthesis. And again, it has to do with righteous, the righteous. Chapter 10 is about the angel and the little scroll. If you want to understand Revelation chapter 10, just go through and read Daniel chapter 10. Because Daniel chapter 10, remember at the end of, actually I don't think it's Daniel 10, I have that in my notes, but I think it's Daniel 13. You remember at the end of Daniel, when the angel stands 1 foot on the water, 1 foot in the sea, and he takes this oath, and then he tells, let's see if I can find it here. Verse 5 of Daniel 12, I, Daniel, looked, there before me stood two others, one on his this bank of the river, and the other on the opposite. One of them said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river. Okay, he was described already before. But he's standing with his feet on water and land. And then he says, how long until this is fulfilled? And the man clothed in linen, verse 7, who was above the waters of the river, lifted his right hand and his left hand toward heaven. That's the oath. And I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying it will be for time and half a time, and the power of the holy ones have been finally, the holy people finally broken. All these things will be completed. I heard that I did not understand, my Lord, what will be the outcome? And he said, go your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Daniel says, tell me more. And the angel said, no. Now, here's the same angel in the same posture. Look at verse 5. The angel I had seen standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven, same activity, and he swore by him who lives forever and ever, same oath. And he says this, verse 7, or verse end of verse 6, there will be no more delay. Everything's identical except what he says this time is the opposite of what he said last time. He said, I'm not going to tell you, that's for the end time. Now this angel stands there, does the same thing, and he says, okay, there's no more delay, the time has come, and there's some more revelations that have to happen here. So that's what that's about. And then chapter 11 is the two witnesses. Well, I won't talk about two witnesses. So anyway, that's just the parenthesis. I don't want you to lose the flow of the book here. Okay, now we got to this next section. The conflict with Satan. Chapters 12 to 14. Oh, and the seventh trumpet. See, the seventh never really works out. Never really is much of anything. The seventh angel sounded his trumpet, and there was loud voices, and then just praise God. They love it. There's all this worship that goes on as a result of the trumpet, but it doesn't say what happens. And then you're sort of left hanging. So you got another kind of dot, dot, dot. And then we go on to the next deal here, chapter 12. This whole thing with the conflict of Satan. And here's how it works out. Chapter 12 is all about Jesus' first coming. There's this dragon and a pregnant woman. Pregnant woman is Israel, pregnant with Jesus. She gives birth to the male child. The dragon tries to devour him. God rescues him. He's taken up into heaven. That's the ascension. The dragon gets upset, turns towards Israel, can't have any luck against Israel because she's protected. And so, at the end of that chapter, verse 17, then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of all her offspring, those who obey God's commandments and hold the testimony of Jesus. And the dragon stood on the shore of the sea. So he just turns all his fury towards the rest of the redeemed. By the way, you have to have a distinction between Israel and the rest of the redeemed there. In case you're wondering if you should be a covenant theologian. Okay, so
what?
Unless you're wondering if you should be a covenant. Covenant theology says that there's no distinction between the church and Israel. The church replaced Israel, Israel's done, and now we're Israel. And here you have a distinction, so no one's in charge for that. Okay, so where does chapter 12 fit in? If we think of Jesus' paradigm here, where does chapter 12 fit in? Fits in right at the beginning, doesn't it? Right at the beginning here. It's right at the beginning of this first section. It's back when Jesus is on the earth and so on. And it extends all the way out. I mean, it extends this whole period. Okay. So that's chapter 12. Now, what happens in chapter 13? You have the beast out of the sea with the 10 horns, 10 crowns. That's the beast. And then you have the beast out of the earth. Chapter 13 is all about who? The Antichrist and his kingdom. Where does that fall in Jesus' scheme? Yeah, right under abomination. Right here. So that's chapter, this is 12. This is 13. Never get it right on these. Okay, chapter 13. Then you have another little interlude here with the 144,000, and all it says just keeps on talking about how pure and holy they are. Doesn't say much else. First few verses of chapter 14. So that's a little parenthetical interlude. Now, verse 6, chapter 14. Three angels appear in this chapter. And they just talk about what's going to happen. They talk about the fact that Babylon is going to fall. We'll see that in a few chapters. They talk about the wine. He too, verse 10, he too will drink the wine of God's fury, which is poured out in full strength, the cup of his wrath. Talking about judgment. They're just basically these three angels talking about this horrendous judgment that's about to occur. Judgment announced. And then after the judgment is announced, verse 14, here's what happens. Verses 14 through the end of the chapter, how can we summarize that? I looked, there before me was a white cloud, seated on the cloud, one like the Son of Man with a crown of gold. The angel comes, tells him to reap. He reaps. Verse 16, he was seated on the cloud, swung his sickle over the whole earth, and the earth was harvested. Verse 17, then another angel came out of the temple in heaven. He too had a sharp sickle. He swung his sickle in verse 19 over the earth and gathered the grapes. And it was harvested. Now, how would you summarize verses 14 through the end of the chapter? The harvest? Go way out on a limb and say it's the harvest? Okay, where does that fit? You have the announcement of judgment, which I think fits with the cataclysmic stuff here, the great announcement of judgment, and in the first part of 14, what is it, 1 through 6 or something, and then you have the harvest in the rest of chapter 14. Now, the bowls. We are in chapter 15 now. There are seven bowls of God's wrath. Bowls 1 through 4 are given in chapter 16. Bowl number 1, verse 2. Where is bowl number 1 poured out? On the land. Where is bowl number 2 poured out? Verse 3. On the sea. Bowl number 3 in verse 4, in the rivers. And the next one in verse 8. The fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and the sun was not given power to scorch people and so on. Now, does that sound familiar? You see how the bowls match up exactly with the trumpets. The first bowls 1 through 4 match up exactly with trumpets 1 through 4. Natural disasters poured out first on the earth, then the seas and the rivers, then the sun, moon, and stars. So that matches perfectly. And they're slightly different. These are God pouring out his wrath. The trumpets are slightly different. I mean, these are angels announcing judgment. So they're counterparts. Total natural disaster. Then number 5 is about actually on the throne of the beast. That means that that's his power. And number 6 is poured out on the Euphrates, which sets up Armageddon, the whole battle of Armageddon. That has to do with the armies there. Verse 16, they gathered the kings together to the place in Hebrew is called Armageddon. And then the 7th bowl of wrath poured out into the air. And that really causes trouble, that particular bowl. Verse 18, flashes of lightning, rumbling, peals of thunder, severe earthquake, no earthquake like it ever occurred since man has been on the earth, so tremendous was the quake. Cataclysm. And I put all this, I just think all this fits right in here somewhere. It's the final pouring out of God's wrath right at the end. And it kind of fits the flow of some of the same stuff, but it's the extreme amount of all of it. So you have 1 through 4 natural disasters, then 5 is basically the beast judge, and number 6, Armageddon, and then number 7, total cataclysm. Times and half time is mentioned a few places. It's mentioned during the two witnesses. It's mentioned during the I think the somewhere in that conflict with Satan interlude is mentioned in there. And I think it's mentioned during the 7th trumpets. I don't think the events in the whole book of Revelation are linear all the way from beginning to end. I think it's better read this way, since this is our paradigm we know for sure, and since each one of them fit into this, not all of it, but I mean they always follow this flow. If you just start over every time you get to a new section, that everybody agrees are the sections of Revelation. So instead of this thing just sort of cycling and getting worse, like sometimes is an interpretation, I think probably a better way to look at the book of Revelation is to say, here's one description of the end times, here's another one, here's another one, here's another one. And they keep following the same pattern. And so, otherwise, you have problems. You have tremendous problems. You get, for one thing, we know chapter 12 jumps back. Because we're in the end times before chapter 12, and then all of a sudden in chapter 12, you're back to the birth of Jesus. So we know it can't be completely linear in time. And it just seems to make better sense this way. You run into all the problems. You get to total cataclysm, and then you start over again with wars and earthquakes. And then you get to total cataclysm, and you start over again. Now, Revelation, you could take some different outlines of Revelation. I could show you 100 different outlines of Revelation. And every one of them, you can make a case for it. But the reason I go with this one is because all I did this week was I just got rid of everything else. I just got a piece of paper in my Bible. And I just read the book of Revelation thinking about Matthew 24. And I just wrote down exactly what happens. And this is the way it shakes out. I got my little pieces of paper and I just lined them up and I said, well, this is what it is. These are the obvious sections. There's no dispute that these are the obvious sections of the book. And they all follow in this order. They don't cover every part of this, but they all follow in this order of Matthew 24. So I think it's the best way to look at it. Now the good part. This is all very, very negative. Now, it's encouraging because throughout, and I didn't take the time to point them out, but you keep getting statements saying things like time, times, and half the time, which indicates that it's going to be a time that's going to seem long, it's going to be cut short, supernatural. You have these statements like this calls for perseverance on the part of the saints. Remember reading that? I mean, you keep seeing that periodically in the book of Revelation. All this trouble. Then you have a parenthesis about the redeemed. Don't forget, folks, you're going through this trouble, but don't forget God's in charge. Don't forget you've been stamped on your forehead by God. Don't forget that God is going to preserve you. And this is trouble from the outset, but it calls for patient endurance on the part of the saints. Why? Because the end is just about to come. And it's going to come dramatically and suddenly. I think in the tribulation time, we are going to cling, believers who are living then are going to cling to this book, reading over and over and over and over, and wearing out on the page the part that this calls for patient endurance on the part of the saints. Because that'll give such hope. Now, here's why it gives hope, because of the end of the book. Let's look at chapter 17, verse 1 through the end of the book, and you're going to see the whole point of the book of Revelation. The whole point of the book of Revelation isn't just disaster, 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 disaster. That's not the point.
So, turn my page over to it,
the other side. Yeah, right. Turn your page over to the other side. Very good. Now, let me show you why I think this is the structure and why I don't believe you can remove the millennium out from between chapter 17, verses 19, chapter 17 through 19:10, and chapter 21 through 22:9. In between those is the millennium. And I don't think you can extricate the millennium from there, and here's why. Let's watch how this fits together. I want you to see the structure so that you know this isn't some scheme that I've thought up in my brain, but this is obvious from the text. Revelation 17:1 through 19:10, that first box on the left, is all about the whore of Babylon, the great prostitute Babylon. Revelation 21:9 through 22:9, 21:9 through 22:9 is about the New Jerusalem. Watch the comparisons. Verse 1 of the first section. Those seven angels who had the seven bowls came, and one of them came and said to me, come and I'll show you the punishment of great prostitute. Look at the other one. One of the seven angels who had seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came to me and said, come, I'll show you the bride, the wife. You see that, how parallel that is? Look at verse 3, all the stuff I have highlighted. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit to the desert, verse 10 on the other side, and he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain. You have precious stones in verse 4, precious jewels over there on the other side. And then you have the main body of the vision about Babylon, and you have the main body of the vision about the New Jerusalem there. And then look how they wrap up. Verse 9 of chapter 19, the angel said to me, 22:6, the angel said to me, these words are trustworthy and true. Back to chapter 19, these words are true words of God. Very parallel. And then look at John's response at the end, verse 10. At this I fell down at his feet to worship him, but he said to me, do not do it. I am a fellow servant with you and with your brothers who hold to the testimony of Jesus. Worship God. Now look at, and then he goes through this other thing. He gets to the New Jerusalem. He gets to the end of that vision. And I fell down at the feet of the angel who had been showing them to me. But he said to me, do not do it. I am a fellow servant with you and your brothers, the prophets and all who keep the words of this book. Worship God. So there's an incredible amount of parallelism. There's no question that he's trying to paint a grand picture of moving from one kingdom over to another kingdom. And in between, something happens, and we'll get to that. But for now, understand that this whole section from 17 to the end of the book is the kingdom of Satan here, with Satan ruling, moving from that to the God city, where God rules. That's the New Jerusalem. And there's going to be a transfer from one to the other. And the major part of chapters 17 through 19 is what? Singing and rejoicing and shouting, because God overthrows this city. And this city is characterized by weeping and sorrow and pain. And what's this? No tears, no sorrow, no pain. So this is the story of the transfer from this mess we're in here to this incredible glory of the New Jerusalem. And what brings us across? What transfers us from here over to here? And it's that part in the middle, the millennium. 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth with us. That is, we will have our glorified bodies. We will be reigning in Jerusalem with Jesus Christ for 1,000 years on this earth. And where is Satan during this 1,000 years? Bound in this time. At the end of the 1,000 years, there's the final great white throne judgment that takes place. And what happens to Satan there? Where is Satan here?
In the lake of fire.
Yeah, in the lake of fire. During the New Jerusalem, he's done. He's buried. I mean, he is in the bottom of the pit, the lake of fire. He is absolutely, he's history. He goes from up here to being bound. He's let loose right here. And, you know, you have the final battle and everything, and then the final judgment, and he's defeated, and now he's down here. This is the story of Satan going from here down to here. Okay? And it's the story of going from this mess to this glory. And it comes through this process. And it's the great hope of all Christians. It's the great hope of everything we do. And I got a little note at the bottom. I don't know if I put it in your notes. 19, another parallel. With Babylon, with her, all the kings of the earth committed adultery. The New Jerusalem, the nations will walk by its light, and all the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. All the kings of the earth relating to each of the cities. It's definitely a parallel. There's no question that John is comparing all this to all this. And they're all opposites. And if we go from here to here through this.
Between the end of your era of 1,000 years, and that could be a year, that could be...
We don't know. I mean, it's not clear exactly. I mean, it seems like it would be some time if you're going to have a huge battle of Armageddon. If you're going to have the devil going around and organizing and orchestrating all the evil that's not been organized and orchestrated during the 1,000 years. During the 1,000 years, you do have sin. You have sinful mortals, but they're not able to develop the vast system of evil that we have now. Because Satan's not there. He's bound. He's not able to organize it, whereas he is at the end when he's let loose. And so you do have a period here, and I don't mean to try and imply that you don't. I just drew the picture this way so that you see the structure of John is set up to give us this incredible hope that we're going to go from here to here. This is why you're weeping. This is what you're looking towards. And that's the whole point of the book of Revelation. So the book of Revelation is a book of great hope. I hope you don't get bogged down and cut out before you get to chapters 17 through the end, because this is the whole point. All that other stuff is the preliminary leading up to, I mean, this is, you know, those dot, dot, dots that were left over from the earlier part of the book? This is what the dot, dot, dots are. This is what he gets to. He says, let me give you a preliminary, and then dot, 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 let me tell you what's going to happen. There's some stuff that happens after that, but let me go through this again. Dot, 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 there's great stuff that happens after that. He gives you the preliminary, and then he says, okay, now here's what I've been talking about. Here's the great stuff that happens afterwards, and it's this. So, that's our great hope. That's what we look forward to. And that's why you don't see a clear statement in the book of Revelation about some of the stuff that we wonder about. Why don't we find a clear statement about the rapture? Why don't we find a clear statement even about the second coming? I mean, there's an indication that he comes and there's the harvest, but it's not real stated in real obvious, succinct, clear terms. The reason for all that is because he's making this point. He's not making other points. He's not writing to fulfill all our curiosity. He's just making this point. That's right. That's one of the questions. One of the difficulties with the millennium is who are the unbelievers populating the millennium? Now, here's where the pre-tribbers have an advantage over me. The pre-tribbers say, oh, they're just the people that are converted during the. Or, I mean, the millennium is populated by people who are converted during the 7 years after the rapture, but they're not going to glorify bodies. Since I believe the rapture is after the 7 years, then, you know, the judgment happens at the rapture. And if all the unbelievers are thrown into hell and all the believers are glorified, who are the mortals that populate the kingdom? The answer to that, to get the answer to that, you're going to have to go to Jeff Yates, who has a whole list of passages that actually indicate that there may very well be survivors. Scripture in the Old Testament and New Testament gives indication that there are survivors of that judgment